can historical traumas help us empathize with climate refugees?
I think that people carry these traumatic pasts with us, possibly in our DNA, but we certainly carry it with us in our generational memories. And I think it does affect how we live, and hopefully it can affect our empathy for people who are the most vulnerable right now.
That's Ellen Meeropol. Her novel, Sometimes an Island, imagines communities navigating a world reshaped by climate disruption, where survival depends on cooperation, memory, and care for the land. Then, how can we solve our plastics problem?
We need new laws on the book that require reduction, refill, reuse, and provide funding to build that infrastructure. If we do that, we will see a significant reduction in the use of plastic and a measurable improvement in our own health.
Judith Enck tells us how the plastic crisis was engineered and how we can fight back. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Ellen Meeropol's Sometimes an Island is a mosaic novel shaped by climate upheaval, migration, and memory. Her characters, activists, elders, and families, don't just endure crisis, they attempt something harder, to build new ways of living together. Meeropol's work highlights a central challenge of climate crisis storytelling: how to balance the immense scale of the crisis with the intimacy of human experience. Rather than leaning into dystopia, she focuses on response. How do people adapt, rebuild, and find meaning in a destabilized world? The novel Sometimes an Island also draws connections between past migrations, like the pogroms that drove Eastern European Jews to find refuge in America, and present-day climate displacement, suggesting that resilience is both historical and ongoing. And she explores the necessary connections between old and young as the wisdom of one joins the energy of the other to weave strong bonds to protect communities. Ellen Meeropol is the author of 6 novels, including Her Sister's Tattoo, Kinship of Clover, and On Hurricane Island. Those she's told us about on previous guest appearances on Writer's Voice. Let's hear our conversation with her today about Sometimes an Island. Ellen Meeropol, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be back.
There were many elements in this new book, a kind of mosaic of stories, as you call it, a novel in stories, that we've actually talked about before, because it harkens back to some of your other novels and stories as well. You start out very much laying the ground for what is going to happen. In the prologue, you talk about 3 communities that are fleeing danger, 3 intentional families facing what you call the great undoing of 2029. Briefly orient us to this story. What's happening?
It's set in the dozen or so years leading up to and following a climate disaster called The Undoing. The characters are from 3 communities. One is an off-the-grid cooperative in Western Mass. One is a neighborhood of immigrants and their descendants who fled the pogroms in Europe in the early years of the 20th century and settled on an island in Penobscot Bay. And the third is a homestead in rural Maine. These characters come together to try to live in better harmony with the land as the climate emergency deepens. And that's the setting for how these different stories fit together.
they're really braided together, and you also braid past and future. I mean, the prologue, as well as many mentions throughout the book, place the pogroms in the Pale of Settlement that you just referred alongside climate refugees or people who are leaving because of the climate catastrophe. Why was it important for you to braid Jewish exile of past centuries with climate displacement? What resonates between these two histories?
So many of us are descendants of people who migrated to this country in search of safety or sustenance. And that's essentially why migration and climate disaster belong together. We are all at risk, and we all hold the possibility of making it better. In my mind, these two things that are usually separate in the way we think about the challenges that face our world today, in my mind, they really are together. The movement of people around the world as the world becomes so much more dangerous in so many ways, and as more and more people become vulnerable.
There's a particular history that you reference also, so fold that in, because these figures who are escaping climate disaster or are planning for it in the future are always referring back to the escaping from the pogroms. And by the way, my family as well, my mother's side came from that. So what about that particular history resonates?
I think as I've become more involved in the last few years with immigration justice work, it's become clear to me how universal some of these issues are. I think that people carry these traumatic pasts with us, possibly in our DNA. I think that's such an interesting idea, although I don't really entirely understand the science of it. But we certainly carry it with us in our generational memories. And I think it does affect how we live. And hopefully it can affect our empathy for people who are the most vulnerable right now. And I think that's one of the things I'm trying to understand in writing this book and trying to share with readers.
And the meaning of island, this is, I think, very important. Not only are you referring to your fictional version of the Fox Islands in Penobscot Bay, is that right? Is that where they are?
Yes.
But the communities themselves, these intentional communities, are also islands. What does an island symbolize for you in this book?
Connection. I fell in love with this island, the real version of it, 25 years ago when I started writing fiction. It's where I first started very seriously writing fiction. And there's something about the isolation that increases the connection people feel with each other and the dependence that they have on each other and the way that they know they have to rely on each other. And that's true in each of these fictional, intentional communities in the novel. Not that all is rosy and happy within them, of course, but that there is a deep connection, whether it's a neighborhood or a cooperative. People rely on each other, and they're family with each other. I think that that connection is something that is increasingly missing in our world today, which may be one of the reasons why I'm so fascinated and curious about it.
Missing in our world today, connection, yes, and yet we are also connected with each other in such a disconnected way.
That's true.
Whereas islands, as you refer to them here, are disconnected in a physical way to the mainland, and yet, as you say, they foster connection. So describe these three communities, the island, the homestead, and the co-op.
So the island is in some ways the easiest to describe. Jewish families, actually a few Jewish individuals who fled the Pale of Settlement, settled on a particular area of this island. And they intermarried, and their families grew there, and their descendants mostly stayed. But then there's climate change, and there's rising sea levels. And some of those descendants, looking ahead, realized that they had to find higher ground. They had to find a safer place to raise their families. And so some of them moved to rural inland Maine, where they created a homestead and invited family and friends to join them. Some of the people who joined them were part of an activist community in Western Massachusetts, an off-the-grid cooperative in an old factory building. And they had been climate change activists. One of their members ended up in prison after an action that didn't go so well. So they end up all together in, or some people from each community end up all together in this homestead in Maine. And that's sort of how they all sort of fit together.
And each of these is fleeing danger. You know, climate is one, but there are also other reasons why they flee. Are intentional communities refuge? Are they denial of reality? In other words, are people just getting away and then kind of leaving the struggle behind? Resistance or in some way all three?
I think it probably depends on the community. Certainly, there are intentional communities that are very involved with members outside of their community. On the island, people interact with other islanders. They're isolated in a section of the island, but they're very much a part of the island. And I think that the cooperative as well is very involved with the community. And when there is a need, they welcome the community into their building and provide refuge and help for people. So I don't see it as a way of escaping reality. I see intentional communities as potentially a way that people gather strength from each other in order to do their community work even better.
Western Massachusetts, where you've lived for many years, is famous for being home to intentional communities, so much so that I've seen several novels that reference intentional communities in Western Mass. what have you taken from that? And have you had your own experience or knowledge of these kinds of communities?
Most of what I know about intentional communities currently, contemporary, are co-housing, which is a big idea in various parts of the country, including right here, where people share housing in various ways and really try to work together rather than duplicating. Everybody doesn't need a lawnmower. Most people don't need a lawn. So that's what I primarily see these days. My own experience with intentional communities comes more from the 60s with living in a communal setting of activists doing anti-war work. And I think my fascination with the concept probably comes from that experience.
Ellen Meeropol, in this book, Sometimes an Island, probably more than, if And I've not read all your books, but it seems like climate change is more at the center of this than others that you've written. And I found that the climate, awareness of the climate catastrophe is cropping up in fiction far more than ever before, but less and less in the public discourse. What's your sense of this, and why is this happening?
That's interesting. My third novel, Kinship of Clover, really focused on climate issues. And the main character was a young man who was so desperately involved with disappearing plant species that they grew into his body in a sort of magical realism kind of way. Jeremy's back in this book, as I said, I often bring characters back. And I think that I agree with you about the ways in which climate fiction has become a genre of its own. I have to say that writing fiction about the climate crisis is almost as impossible as it is imperative to do. I mean, think about what issue is more likely to divide people into opposite camps, either passionate or apathetic, either knowledgeable or ignorant, either activist or dismissive. The challenge is really immense. I mean, how do you dramatize impending doom? And so I think if you want to write climate fiction, you have to really find a balance between science and story. Too much science slows the narrative. And science doesn't tell us what to do. Science tells us what is. The story can inspire action through empathy with characters. And you also have to try to find a balance between despair and hope. The emergency is real, and that can lead to a pretty grim story. But soft peddling that reality feels dishonest. So, you know, I think it's incredibly important that people are writing these stories, but it is a real challenge to do so.
Well, I think you do it very well. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Ellen Mirapol about her latest, Sometimes an Island. It imagines three linked communities navigating a world reshaped by climate disruption. I was thinking to myself the other day, you know, kind of mulling over this question as the climate emergency emerges ever more catastrophically as we can see it around us and the scientific warnings become greater. You know, why is it that it has just so dropped away? I mean, so much so that here in New York State, we have a governor who claims that she's an environmentalist, but is trying to undermine our innovative and sweeping climate law that was passed in 2019. And I thought to myself, it's almost as if people are already dealing with so much trauma and uncertainty and fear and terror that they cannot allow something that is even greater than that, which is the climate catastrophe, something they feel so helpless to attack, to intrude on their consciousness. And yet you can do that with stories. And you even say in this book, our stories just might save us. So talk a little bit more about the process. You just said how difficult it was to write climate fiction, but also what does fiction do for us?
I don't know that I have a good answer for that, Francesca. I did not plan to write this book. After my last novel was published in 2022, I decided to focus on short stories and not do another book. It felt too overwhelming, partly because of what you just talked about. But as I gathered drafts of stories I had already written, and I started writing new ones. And I realized that these stories wanted to play with each other, and they were really about climate change. I decided to go ahead and write it with misgivings. And in fact, when my younger daughter read an early draft of this book, her comment was, "This is pretty grim, Ma." And I had to go back and rethink, how do you give hope in a book that's about something as frightening as this is? I mean, along with the potential for nuclear war, the climate crisis is a major threat to human life and is connected with issues of injustice all around the world. So, you know, writing this stuff is almost an act of growth in itself. I don't think that fiction does a great job at telling people how to act. I think that the best that fiction can do is help us really think about the issues that face us through the living of lives of characters on the page, and our empathy with them and their stories, and hopefully inspiring each of us to figure out how we can play a small part in changing the way things are. It's kind of a magical process, that feeling of really caring about a character who comes alive on a page. And I know that for me as a reader, that empathy is critical in how I think about the world and how I want to participate in it.
Yeah, I think empathy is the key word there. You make something that seems far off and impersonal very personal and intimate. But I'm not sure I agree with you that fiction can't tell us what to do. Because I think very much in this novel, as well as in other novels that I know have inspired me through, you know, the decades, really, novels are a place where you can picture, you can show in pictures, basically, in the pictures in the mind, what people do to reconstruct their lives. I mean, for example, in this book, the characters move from intellectual professions, you know, activists, teachers, professors, to farming, to garden, to creating survival in a way that creates thriving as well. So it feels to me that you are showing, first of all, what kinds of knowledge that matter in a destabilizing world or that could matter to us. And you're also showing how people choose, instead of the dystopian idea of every man against every other man, and I use that gendered word intentionally, you show people working together, and working together especially with the leadership of old women.
Yes. And the question of how we look at multi-generational activism is something that I really care about. As a reader, I'm always looking for novels in which older characters are the focus. Our culture is so youth-focused, and fiction is so youth-focused, but I also want to see what older people with decades and decades of experience, how they navigate the world. And this was a very intentional focus on my part, to have most of the main characters, certainly most of the narrators be older people, older women in particular. I'm glad that you feel that stories can help people figure out what to do. You know, as a fiction writer engaged with political issues, the danger of becoming didactic is so clear to me. And I feel that it's such a turnoff to me when I read a book that starts preaching at me. It's often, you know, the end of my reading that book. So the crafting of ideas of how to respond within story, I think, is difficult and really critically important in the climate fiction world. The other thing that climate fiction sometimes does is focus enormously on the really dystopia elements, how awful it is, how violent it is. And that wasn't my interest in this book. I sometimes think of it as dystopia light, because the climate emergency is very present and the results are very present. But the focus of the stories is on how people react and how they try to build and rebuild and think about rebuilding and think about how we might better, as flawed human beings, best live on this earth.
Mm. Yes. Now, your own family history includes profound encounters with state power and political injustice. You're married to Robbie Meeropol, who is the son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. I mean, without drawing any direct parallels, how does living inside that legacy shape how you imagine resistance and moral courage in your books?
Well, I think in a couple of ways. One is that given my family history, I met Robbie when I was 19, so I feel like it's my history as well as his. Resistance doesn't feel like an option. It feels like what you have to do. And I think that's one way in which my situation might be different from other people who might feel like there is a choice. I think that the other way it has affected the way I look at the world is that people often say, oh, that couldn't happen. Fascism could not come to the United States, or climate change isn't really that bad. It's not gonna really destroy our world. I know that, in fact, these very bad things can happen, because they did in my family. Robbie's parents were executed by the government. They were murdered. Bad things can happen. And so perhaps that's one important way as well in how this family history has affected my view of the world and how it has become part of the background, the backstory of Sometimes an Island.
Well, it is really a terrific read. Sometimes an Island, a mosaic novel of family ties, climate upheaval, and resilience. Ellen Meeropol, thanks so much for coming back to Writer's Voice to talk about it.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Ellen Meeropol. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our other conversations with her about her novels, Her Sister's Tattoo, Kinship of Clover, and On Hurricane Island. Next up, the problem with plastic and what to do about it. Stay tuned after this clip from the trailer to the new Netflix documentary, The Plastic Detox.
Microplastics are in everything now.
Plastic leaches a crap ton of chemicals.
Even the smallest levels of exposure can have profound effects.
Fertility worldwide is going down, and it is tightly linked to chemicals that are commonly used in plastic.
Yeah, I've been trying to get pregnant for over 10 years now.
22 months.
2.5 years? Say what you always call yourself.
I say, you know, Julie, I'm not a human dildo.
That was a clip from the trailer to the new Netflix documentary, The Plastic Detox. And the plastic crisis is our topic in this next segment. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Judith Enck joins us to talk about her book, written with Adam Mahoney, The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. In 2009, Judith Enck was appointed Regional Administrator of Region 2 of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency by President Obama. She was the longest-serving EPA Region 2 Regional Administrator. Enck is the founder of Beyond Plastics, a national organization that works on the problem of plastic pollution. She argues that the global plastic crisis is not an accident, but a strategic shift by the fossil fuel industry. As demand for fossil fuels declines in energy and transportation, companies have turned to plastics as a new growth market. Enck breaks down the myths of plastic recycling, the health impacts of plastic pollution, and the policy solutions we need to reduce plastic production and waste. She emphasizes local and state-level action as key leverage points for change. Let's listen now. Judith Enck, welcome to Writer's Voice.
I'm thrilled to be with you. Thank you, Francesca.
Well, we've been hearing a lot about the plastic problem and the microplastic problem now for a long time. It seems pretty dire. Your book, The Problem with Plastic, makes a powerful argument that the plastic crisis has not been accidental. In fact, it has been engineered. What do you mean by that?
Well, for so many years, fossil fuel companies made money from selling fossil fuels for electricity generation at power plants and also for transportation, putting petroleum products in cars and trucks. So what's going on with those two sectors? On the electricity side, we're finally seeing a slow improvement toward renewable energy like solar, wind, geothermal, and of course, energy efficiency. And then on the transportation side, we're seeing more and more electric vehicles, including trucks. So a number of years ago, fossil fuel companies realized they are going to be losing sales. And they decided to make plastic plan B for the fossil fuel industry. Plastic is made from 16,000 different chemicals and from ethane, which is a waste product from hydrofracking. And what we have seen in the last few years is companies like Shell and Exxon building these multi-billion dollar facilities called ethane cracker facilities, where they take the waste product from fracking, heat it at a really high temperature, thus the word crack, and then they turn it into billions and billions of little pieces of pre-production plastics. So we've got that going on. And then at the same time, we still have plastic companies deceiving the public about the recycling of plastics. Many people think you can just toss all sorts of plastics into your recycling bin, when in fact, most plastics in the United States never get recycled, even if you put them in your recycling bin. The only plastics that get recycled are soda bottles, especially if you're in one of the 10 states that have returnable beverage container laws known as bottle bills, or you can rest assured that milk jugs and detergent bottles do get recycled. but the U.S. recycling rate for plastic is only 5 to 6%. People are surprised when they hear that because millions of dollars has been spent by the fossil fuel, chemical, and plastics industry trying to convince the public that we don't have to worry about all of the plastics because we can recycle it. And that's simply not true. The reason, and I want to be clear, people should keep recycling paper, cardboard, metal, and glass. Please consider composting yard waste and food waste. But when you have, say, an aluminum can, you can recycle an old aluminum can into a new aluminum can. It doesn't work that way with plastic because it's too diverse. There are 16,000 different chemicals used to make plastics, different colors, different types of plastics called polymers. So if you think of your own home or apartment, you might have a bright orange hard plastic detergent bottle near your washing machine. And then in your kitchen, you might have a thin plastic bread bag. Those two plastics cannot be recycled together. Different colors, different types of plastic, different chemical combinations. That's why plastic recycling largely has not worked. And the people who know that are the plastics industry, yet they have spent millions of dollars trying to deceive the public into thinking that we can recycle most plastics when we can't.
Yeah, and I just have a quick little detail question on that. You know, we have these little chasing arrow symbol that appears on over almost every plastic product, and they have numbers inside. And I thought that if it was number one, it was recyclable. But there's number one on things that are not the items that you mentioned.
Yeah, you know, generally, the guidance you can rely on is number one and number two plastics. Most of them will get recycled, certainly not all of them. But I would never put anything other than number one and number two into your recycling bin.
Oh, that's a good thing to know. Now, in the 1950s, you write about in this book, in The Problem with Plastic, that throwaway living was celebrated as modern and liberating. What have we paid for the cost of convenience?
Well, we live in a throwaway society. So many things are not durable. When they break, you can't get them repaired, or it's more expensive to repair them than buy new. And we're paying with our health. I mean, the most obvious impact is landfills that are filling up and garbage incinerators that are burning garbage and making air pollution. But it goes much deeper than that. I think you want to look at natural resource depletion, energy usage. We are not sustainable as a society. There really is no away when you think about the throwaway society. And we're paying for it with our health. There's increased rates of cancer that cannot be explained by better screening. More and more children suffer with asthma, far more than when I was growing up. And recently, we have seen many toxic chemicals linked to fertility problems. And in fact, there's a new movie coming out on Netflix in mid-March called The Plastic Detox. And it addresses the issue of plastics and chemicals and fertility rates. So we're paying a steep price for this so-called convenience. And I argue that there are alternatives to plastics that still allow for safe food and convenience, but we just need to move away from our heavy reliance on plastic. I mean, two more points I'll make. One is, no one has voted for more plastic. And nothing tastes better in plastic.
What a surprise. I'd like to come back actually to those alternatives a little bit later, but the costs have been, yes, environmental, which are devastating. I mean, not just reproductive, but also there are people who say that are part, at least, of our obesity epidemic is driven by the obesogens that plastic represents. There are all kinds of, metabolic disorders that could be related to that. But taxpayers are also paying for the externalized costs of the plastic industry. How does that work?
Oh, I love to talk about environmental externalities. Thank you. So it works two ways. One is when you're manufacturing plastic, which mostly happens in Louisiana, Texas, and Appalachia. The manufacturing of plastic causes a lot of pollution and health damage. There's a stretch of the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and New Orleans, 85 miles, where there's a concentration of petrochemical facilities. That part of Louisiana is referred to as Cancer Alley. It has been for decades. And just saying that kind of hurts my heart. But a recent study by Johns Hopkins documents that the cancer rate in Cancer Alley, Louisiana, is 7 times the national average. And then you look at the disposal of plastics. Most are not ever recycled. So that means they need to be trucked to landfills and incinerators, another pathway of pollution, but also at great cost to taxpayers. For instance, in New York City, there is not one landfill or one garbage incinerator. So taxpayers in New York City are spending over $500 million every single year exporting waste to the beautiful Finger Lakes, to mega landfills like Seneca Meadows Landfill, or to the garbage incinerator in an environmental justice community in Newark, New Jersey, and other states. So one thing that my organization, Beyond Plastics, advocates for is for producers of this waste to take responsibility for dealing with it. There's a concept called extender producer responsibility, or EPR, where there's a small fee placed on packaging to help local governments pay for recycling and disposal costs. I don't think putting a fee on packaging alone solves the problem, because what happened in Canada and Europe, where they have these laws on the books for decades, is the big companies just pay the fee and don't really change anything. So we're working on a bill, for instance, in the New York State Legislature called the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act, which would require a 30% reduction in single-use plastic packaging over 12 years. Very reasonable. The bill also bans the 17 very toxic chemicals used to make plastic, the whole PFAS family of chemicals, lead, mercury, formaldehyde, for instance. Third provision of the bill is it doesn't allow for polluting chemical recycling, the industry's latest false solution, to count as real recycling. And then finally, there is a modest fee put on packaging, and that new revenue would go to local governments, not just to fund recycling programs, but to fund waste reduction, refill, and reuse initiatives. Just a quick example, so many of our students, millions of kids that go to school every day, are served a hot lunch on single-use plastic packaging. And they eat off of a polystyrene plate, they eat with plastic utensils, they have a plastic drinking water cup. Imagine if our kids could eat healthy food on real dishes that are washed in dishwashing equipment on site. A lot of schools said they would like to do that, but they need the funding to buy the dishwashing equipment and the dishes. One source of funding is the fees from a fee on packaging. We have solutions. We do not need a space age breakthrough on some new material. There are alternatives to plastic, but certainly reducing the use of packaging material in particular, and then investing in the infrastructure for reuse and refill would go a long way towards solving this problem.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Beyond Plastics founder Judith Enck about her new book, The Problem with Plastic: How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late.
And in fact, you reconfigure the old reduce, reuse, recycle to reduce, reuse, refill. Is that correct?
Yes, and rethink.
And rethink. So how would that actually work? Are you talking about, you know, what kinds of containers are people using? How would it work to go to the grocery store? You know, how can we not only reduce and reuse, but also refill?
Well, I'm so impressed with the number of small businesses that have opened around the country just in the last year or two. Some of are known as refilleries. They're refill businesses. So you show up with your own glass or metal containers. And if you need shampoo, you just fill it up in a container. If you need dish soap, you fill it up. And you bring your empty containers back to the refill store with you. Now, for food, we already have a model that some of your listeners are probably familiar with, and that's food co-ops, where you can buy bulk. So you can bring your own jars and stainless steel containers and fill up your rice, your popcorn, you know, mostly dry goods, but also you can refill cooking oil, shampoo, things like that. Also, it wasn't long ago that dairies would sell milk in reusable glass bottles. That is slowly coming back. It wasn't long ago that Coca-Cola Company sold their soda in refillable glass bottles, and parts of the world still have that. But without checking with anyone, Coke decided to move away from refillable glass bottles and present the world with billions of single-use plastic bottles that litter the environment worldwide. I don't think this transition is happening quickly enough, and it's not going to happen just by voluntary initiatives. We need new laws on the book that require reduction, refill, reuse, and provide funding to build that infrastructure. If we do that, we will see a significant reduction in the use of plastic and a measurable improvement in our own health.
The industry itself, the plastics industry, has been promoting, well, you mentioned one of its solutions, chemical recycling, but also other things like waste to energy and bioplastics,
right,
as climate-friendly innovations. Why do you consider these false solutions?
Well, let's take them one by one. Waste to energy is basically burning all of your garbage and creating tiny amounts of electricity. There has not been a new waste-to-energy plant built in this country in the last 30 years, except for one or two in Florida. Thank you, Governor DeSantis. You know, waste-to-energy is just a dying industry, and we're not going to see a lot of that in the future. The chemical companies are really pushing something called chemical recycling. They call it advanced recycling. It's not advanced, and it's not recycling. What it is heating waste plastic at a really high temperature and creating small amounts of fossil fuel. And then there's one or two facilities that attempt to turn waste plastic into new plastic, but that's unusual. And I would argue the last thing we need is more fossil fuel or more plastic. And the plastics and chemical industry is out over their skis on this. They talk about this all the time. They've been trying to perfect this since the 1980s without success. And a few years ago at Beyond Plastics, we wanted to take a look at how many of these facilities actually exist in the United States And what amount of plastic waste are they handling? And what are the environmental impacts? Based on the technology, these facilities are quite polluting and they contribute to climate change. But more than anything else, they don't work. So we looked at 11 permitted facilities and we did a little bit of magical thinking. We did the math based on them operating at full capacity, which they rarely are. And of these 11 facilities, they were only managing a little bit of over 1% of the United States plastic waste. And since we published our report, 3 of the 11 facilities have shut down. So chemical recycling is more of a talking point in a news release than an actual solution to the plastics problem.
And how about bioplastics or the nature imitations, the idea of plastics that are benign to the environment?
Well, there are two parts to that. One is we still want to move away from single use. So single use bioplastic cups and plates and utensils, we should try to avoid. Most of these products claim to be compostable, but we do not recommend you put it in your backyard compost bin, especially if you're going to use the compost to grow fruits or vegetables. They only really break down in high temperature commercial composting operations, of which there are very few in our country. I actually have been watching with great interest for decades to see if there would be a breakthrough on so-called bioplastics. And I'd say they're not there yet. One of the concerns is that some bioplastics actually contain more toxic chemicals than conventional plastics. So, you know, the irony here is people are often spending a lot more money purchasing bioplastics because they have an environmental concern. It's not clear to me that these products are much better than conventional plastics. And you've got to look very, very closely at what the ingredients are.
And finally, you talk about the example of Denmark. I mean, where have there been successful programs to reduce plastics? And is that one of them?
Yeah, I mean, there are some real outstanding accomplishments around Europe. Denmark, Germany, big, big push toward refillable, returnable containers. You know, it also helps if you standardize the containers. I talk occasionally to wineries, and they're spending 80 cents to 90 cents per glass bottle. Wouldn't it be nice if they could get those glass bottles back, not for recycling, but to sanitize them and refill them? You know, there are success stories around the globe, but not a lot of them have been copied here in the U.S. I mean, one really simple, tiny little example I'll share is the European Union adopted a policy, a law, essentially, a few years ago, that all plastic bottle caps need to be tethered to the bottle so those plastic caps are not a source of litter. We don't have that in the United States, even though it is working very well in Europe. So there are 3 states, California, Illinois, and New York, that have legislation pending to copy that policy. So, you know, there are some encouraging laws, a lot of good stuff going on in France. If you go to Starbucks in France, the lid of your single-use coffee cup is not hard plastic. It's a fiber, almost cardboard lid on the top of your single-use coffee cup. So little tiny steps help at a store like Starbucks, where they sell so much product every single day. Of course, you know, the better answer is to bring your own reusable coffee cup.
Yes. So you have worked inside government at the EPA, and now you work outside of it on organizing with Beyond Plastics. Where do you see the most momentum right now? We have a federal government, of course, which is quite hostile to anything that attacks its favorite fossil fuel companies. Where can people work most effectively, local, state, or international?
All of the above, although it is really hard at the national level in the U.S. these days. It is heartbreaking to see Lee Zeldin and the Trump administration dismantle the EPA. This is causing generational damage. It's going to take years to rebuild that agency. I mean, I can cite example after example where they have walked away from their legal obligation to protect public health and the environment. So at the federal level, what you mostly need to do is play whack-a-mole and beat back bad proposals. And there are many. If you want to work to get strong, proactive policies adopted that reduce the production, use, and disposal of plastics, I urge everyone to start at the local level and then climb the ladder to some state-level advocacy. And at my organization, Beyond Plastics, we have a program called Local Groups and Affiliates, where we will work with folks who want to tackle this issue in their community. We provide free training and resources. So I would urge people to go to beyondplastics.org, beyondplastics.org. If you're with an existing group, you can become an affiliate. If you want to start a whole new group, you know, we have Beyond Plastic groups all over the country. And then even if you don't want to be a local group and affiliate, go to our website, sign up for our free email list, because we have lots of information all the time on things you can do, both in your own life and also politically in a nonpartisan way to protect our earth and our health. And what I have noticed working with Beyond Plastics for the last 6 years is one or two people can really make a difference. And in the book, we profile a number of mostly women who are standing up to big plastic and really having an impact. And so, you know, while the book chronicles the many, many problems with plastic, that's the name, the problem with plastic, we also end with cause for hope. We end with real solutions, and we end with what you can do. This is too important an issue to feel discouraged about. This is too big an issue to walk away from. This is a climate change issue. This is an environmental justice issue. This is an ocean issue. We are turning our ocean into a landfill. And mostly, this is a health issue, because none of us should have microplastics in our bodies, but we all do.
Well, that's great, Judith Enck. I have to say, in my own community, we ban single-use plastics. We do not provide plastic forks and spoons automatically.
Great.
You have to ask for them, and it wasn't that difficult to get that done. So your book is an important resource for people who can do this everywhere. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
My pleasure. I hope people enjoy the book. It is really a call to action. Thank you so much.
Go to writersvoice.net to find links to Judith Enck's organization, Beyond Plastics, and resources to help you lower your use of that nasty stuff. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.